Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. The court is delighted to welcome some students who are here with us this morning. We have students from Seymour High School. Would they stand, please? No? If they were here, the court would welcome them. We have students from East High School. Okay, who are all you? All right, good. You may be seated. Is there a student group here that I don't have on my list? All right. Then we welcome the East High School students who are with us. They are here with our Court with Class program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This is a national award-winning program that we have run for many years now. We invite students from all over the state to come join us for an oral argument. The students are given materials about the case they're about to hear, and at noon the students will meet with a justice of this court. The discussion will be about the procedure of the court, not the substance of the case, and all of you are cordially invited, whether student or not, to sit in at that noon presentation. At 11 o'clock, and this is a reminder to the court and to everyone in the audience here, at 11 o'clock there will be a signal. You will hear it. It is a just testing the equipment here, that it'll be an alarm, testing the alarm, but it is not one in which we must evacuate the building. So I just want you to be prepared, and when you see me jump, you will know I am totally prepared on this matter. Now that we have met you and I've made these introductions, let me introduce the court to each of you. And starting on my far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom the students will meet at noon. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. With these introductions made, we will now call our first case for this morning, which is 02-1034, Stephen C. Teetsworth versus Harley-Davidson, Inc. Arguing for Harley-Davidson is W. Stewart Parsons of Quarles and Brady. Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Stuart Parsons, and I represent Harley-Davidson, Inc. and Harley-Davidson Motor Company. I hope this morning to explain the four reasons why we submit that this Court should affirm the decision of the Circuit Court dismissing the complaint in this case. Those four reasons are, number one, this is the paradigm no-harm case where the plaintiffs have suffered no injury. Number two, the economic loss doctrine bars the plaintiff's claims. Number three, even if the economic loss doctrine does not bar the claim asserted under Section 100.18, the elements of the 100.18 claim are lacking. And finally, number four, the plaintiffs have already elected to affirm their contracts by accepting and enjoying their motorcycles and have thereby elected the contract remedy and are precluded from tort remedies. But before I go there to those points, let me set the stage. On January 22, 2001, Harley-Davidson wrote a letter to the owners of approximately 140,000 motorcycles. That letter said, "We have noticed some failures in a few motorcycles of a part in the engine called the rear cam bearing." I have the rear cam bearing. It's a very small wheel within a wheel. The inner wheel revolves on ball bearings, which are between the two wheels.
That part in the record?
This part is, of course, the part alleged in the complaint. I thought the court might want to see what the case is about. We have no record here. This is, of course, a motion to dismiss under for failure to state a claim. Within 6 months after Harley wrote that letter, a law firm of Leaf and Cabraser with other law firms, Leaf and Cabraser in San Francisco and New York, bar in action in Milwaukee County Circuit Court, a class action, apparently on behalf of all the people in the world who had purchased the motorcycles in question, alleging for purposes of this appeal two theories of liability. First, that Harley-Davidson had fraudulently concealed the alleged defect, which Harley had disclosed in its letter of January 22nd. And second, that Harley had advertised its motorcycles deceptively under Section 100.18 of the Wisconsin statutes. The circuit court, of course, dismissed those claims. On appeal, the Court of Appeals reversed the circuit court, reinstated them. Harley petitioned this court, which is why we're here this morning. The first point relates to no injury. It is important to observe here what the plaintiffs do not allege. No plaintiff has been personally injured. Personal injury claims are specifically excluded. No plaintiff has been riding a motorcycle where the engine failed and the plaintiff rider was left stranded in some inconvenient place. There's no such allegation. There's no allegation that any of these plaintiffs have tried to sell their motorcycles but have been unable to do so or unable to do so at a price they consider to be a fair price. There's no allegation that any of these plaintiffs have sold their motorcycles at a loss. The only allegation is that their motorcycles are worth less, a diminished value claim. The claim is that if we were to sell our motorcycles, we wouldn't get as much for them as we should because they have this defect.
They'd be then obligated, if they sold a motorcycle, to let the buyer know that, look, we've got a letter from Harley, and because of that, we just want to put you on notice.
I think probably so, although this is a very open and notorious situation. Harley riders belong to an association called the Harley Owners Group, and they communicate with each other, and Harley communicates with them. This January 22nd letter went, in effect, to the world, and the warranty goes to the purchaser. So
those are Harley, present Harley owners. I'm just talking about the non-Harley owner who might want to buy the bike.
Yeah, well, if you're thinking about buying a Harley bike, you've probably heard about this, but in any event, I think there might very well be such a duty. But I did want to make the point that the new owner will receive this extended warranty. What Harley did on January 22nd was say, because we've seen this problem, we're extending the one-year warranty on your cam bearing to 5 years or 50,000 miles. So you're protected. We don't think you'll have a problem, but if you do, we've extended the warranty there.
If the cycle has 48,000 miles on it and then it's sold. I'm just asking what you think the obligation of the owner is at that point.
The obligation of
you're indicating that everybody in the world, but it's the Harley world, knows about this, but there are people that perhaps don't. I wasn't familiar with it until I read the briefs here.
If If they don't know about it, they get the benefit of a warranty without taking any action. They are warranted for 5 years or 50,000 miles, even though they're a repurchaser. There have been, we counted 27 cases like this, where an automobile manufacturer or other manufacturer has somehow signaled there might be a defect in this product, and there's been a class action alleging fraud started on behalf of all the people who own the automobile in question. Cases involving seat belts, diesel engines, automatic braking systems, and lots of other systems in vehicles that might allegedly have a problem. In 21 of these cases, the plaintiff's allegation was diminished value. The defect has not yet manifested itself in my car, but my car is worth less if I try to resell it. It's the same case as we have here. They are a pattern. And the courts have dismissed, as far as we can tell, every single one of these cases. This is a recent wave. We're talking about cases that are mostly late 1990s and early 2000 cases. There is a quote that recurs in these cases. This comes from a case called Weaver involving an integrated child seatbelt restraint system. The Southern District of New York said in this oft-quoted sentence, "It is well established that purchasers of an allegedly defective product have no legally recognizable claim unless the alleged defect has manifested itself in the product they purchased." Manifested itself, meaning the bearing has to fail.
Counsel, I want to address that argument with regard to 100.18. 100.18, of course, is supposed to mesh with the Department of Agriculture codes. That's part of what 100.18 is all about, 100.18 and 100.20. Now, the Department of Agriculture codes involve things like Ag 125, unfair mobile home practices. For those who have sat in small claims court, we're all familiar with, I think it is Ag 32 or 132, motor vehicle repair practices, door-to-door solicitation, 127. Okay, let's just take mobile home practices. Mobile home, one practice that hypothetically exists in the past, is that these mobile home parks were just not treating their tenants fairly and had all sorts of restrictions. You got to buy your skirt through us for your mobile home, and you have to have this mobile home. And when you sell the mobile home, you've got to use us as the real estate agent. Okay. My concern here is I don't want to mess up 100.18 and what it was intended to do as it works with 100.20 and the ag codes. Are you suggesting that in order for an enforcement action to be brought or in order for a private person to bring a cause of action under 100.18, that first of all they would have to, let's say, try to sell the mobile home through a different agent or go ahead and use the realtor and then file a lawsuit as opposed to bringing some kind of action to focus on the practice itself?
Yeah.
Same thing with why the basement code?
The plaintiffs here are invoking the generalized provision of Section 100.18, which very broadly says if you try to sell anything in the world and make a deceptive statement in connection with selling anything in the world to anybody in the world, you have liability. So it's not one of the particularized provisions, and I do not know what particular provisions may exist with respect to mobile homes. With respect to motorcycles, I would say that there is no pecuniary loss if the purchaser got exactly what they bargained for.
Counsel, I can understand your argument, but like I said, I'm concerned with the ramifications. I mean, water in the basement, home improvement code. It seems to me that you're suggesting that if you have these crews that come and advertise, we're going to give you a super-duper job with water in the basement, coating your basement so you'll never have a water problem, and they use an inferior product, and that becomes known that the product is inferior. You got to wait for a couple of years until it fails before you can in some way recoup, before the Department of Justice can proceed or before an individual can recoup some kind of damages?
No. And the difference between that case and this case is that in the cases you were thinking about, the buyer did not get what the buyer bargained for. The buyer bargained for a dry basement, and the buyer got a wet basement. Here, the buyer bargained for a motorcycle. Implicit in the purchase was the possibility of failure. That is why there's a warranty. The buyer got exactly what the buyer bargained for. Nothing has happened to change that, so that in our situation, there is no pecuniary loss in the sense that there is a pecuniary loss in the cases that you have in mind.
In my hypothetical, the water has not yet come into the basement. They just use an inferior product, which years ago was one of the problems with these roaming crews that would come around. And so, you know, I understand with regard to this case and Harley-Davidson the argument. It's just that I don't want – we've got a whole tightly interwoven Department of Ag, Department of Justice, 100.18, 100.20, and I don't want that and the legislative history that goes with that stuff to be skewed, suggesting that you need to have a breakdown before you can bring a cause of action for the practice.
Understood. There are many provisions in Section 100.18 and in the Department of Agriculture rules for enforcement actions, and we're not talking, of course, about enforcement actions, which would be governed by a different standard and which could, of course, be brought well short of any pecuniary loss, because that's not part of the enforcement action program. So,
but 11.2b talks about the private individual also bringing an action, essentially as in a private attorney general on their own behalf.
We say you can bring the action when you've suffered a pecuniary loss, and if you've got what you bargained for, which these Harley owners have gotten, you haven't suffered a pecuniary loss. I want to say one other thing about 118 while we're on the subject. We suggest that the court look carefully at the allegation of advertising involved here. The allegations of the complaint is that Harley advertised that these motorcycles were masterpieces. Get on your Harley and ride, ride, ride. This is exactly the kind of advertising that many of the courts which have dismissed these claims have said is mere puffery, not the kind of advertising that we are concerned about when we're applying a deceptive trade practice statute. So that we urge that there is an alternative ground for dismissing the 100.18 claim, namely that this is not the kind of advertising that should be involved.
Mr. Parsons, suppose you should lose. And suppose that you then go to trial. And, you know, at the moment, I'm not so sure if we agree that with you that there is little or no damage for each particular plaintiff here. Let's just suppose they get $10 a head or 20, I don't know what it's going to be, which is a lot of money for Harley-Davidson because that's a lot of motorcycles. Now, 5 years later, one of these does fail and somebody is injured. Are they barred from suing Harley-Davidson since they've already collected and you should bring all your claims at one time?
That's one of the reasons. The answer is yes, and that's one of the reasons why the courts have not permitted claims like this to proceed. It's because if Harley-Davidson has to pay a class, it's going to be paying for injury that has not yet occurred and that may never occur to members of the class who are receiving this benefit. But that judgment in the class action is certainly going to bar future claims under our rules about res judicata and claim preclusion.
So why don't you settle with them and do that? Save you a lot of money.
We don't want to encourage claims by people who have not been injured. That's why we will not settle with them.
Mr. Parsons, if I might ask a couple of questions. I was thinking about the fact that this past summer, two of the vehicles, not motorcycles, but cars that we own, had recalls for potential defects. And in both instances, we were told that the particular part may or may not fail, but bring your vehicle in and we'll take care of it without cost to you. Why hasn't something like that occurred in this case, or why isn't the same approach applicable in this case?
There are two reasons, but I want to preface my response by observing that they're not of record. So what I'm talking about is what we would expect to show if the case went forward. The two reasons are, number one, no safety issue here. The National Highway Safety Administration has looked at this and has not taken any action. And our own internal analysis indicates that there's no safety issue involved here at all. And number two, this is a sealed part of the engine. Harley does not, is nervous about having mechanics at independent dealers go in and maybe create a problem that didn't exist when they open up this engine. So those are the two reasons why they're all not getting fixed. It's a cost-benefit analysis. It's weighing the benefit that we're likely to create against the injury that we might do in light of the fact that there's not a safety concern here. And I should say something about that safety concern very directly. Unquestionably, the complaint alleges that these motorcycles either prematurely fail or have a tendency, are prone to premature failure, and the complaint alleges that failure can be a sudden failure, suggesting a safety issue. And that those are the allegations with which we must live on this motion. I certainly acknowledge that. I want the court to know that we expect to show at trial that there is no way under the sun that this engine is going to fail suddenly. You hear noise in the bearing as it begins to wear. But that is another subject.
The second question that I have relates to the economic loss doctrine. You've argued that the economic loss doctrine would preclude the common law claim of fraud here and the statutory claim. Could you address that and tell me why you think that's the case?
Right.
I know that's a broad question.
No, it's a fine question, and I recently listened to the oral argument in the DigiCorp case, and I heard that very question from you, Justice Crooks. And I heard
consistency
the answer.
Is something.
I don't know how much time we want to spend on in the wonderful world of DigiCorp and economic loss. So I'll respond briefly, and if there's a follow-up, fine. DigiCorp, 3-2, adopting the Huron Tool rule, if the alleged misrepresentation goes to the heart of the contract, if the misrepresentation is interwoven with the contract, the economic loss doctrine applies. There's no exception. This is the archetypal case where the misrepresentation goes to the quality and characteristics of the product. So if you're going to go the Huron Tool route, there isn't any question but that this case is there. Now, in a three to two decision, this court held the economic loss doctrine applicable, and if that decision is the law in Wisconsin, which we think today it is, clearly the common law fraud claim is barred by the economic loss doctrine, and there's just no issue there. The next question, which is more interesting, is whether the economic loss doctrine bars the 100.18 claim. I know that's a question that Judge Robensack looked at in Kalin, which holds, no, that's inappropriate. 100.18 is a legislative creation, different policy, economic loss doctrine doesn't apply. We suggest you might want to revisit that, but in any event, the court really doesn't have to get to the kind of question you had yesterday, can we graft public policy in a dog bite case? Here, you've got a problem with statutory interpretation. The legislature used the phrase pecuniary loss. You have to decide what that is. You have to interpret that. And one way you could approach that is to say, well, when it used the phrase pecuniary loss, the legislature, you know, knew about the economic loss doctrine, and so we're going to analyze this the way we analyze economic loss cases. Or you could say we're not going to bother with that. We're simply going to define pecuniary loss as meaning the defect must have manifested itself.
Or do you think 100.18 is ambiguous?
Can be what?
You think 100.18 is ambiguous, or do you think it's plain on its face?
Oh, I think there's play in the phrase pecuniary loss. I mean, we say that it may not quite be out of pocket, but it's got to be more than nothing's happened to your product and might never happen to your product. I think the court has to think about what pecuniary loss means.
How about in section number 1, before you get to 11A, where the legislature talks about the representation that precedes the claim here, it says advertisement, announcement, statement, or representation containing any assertion, representation, or statement of fact which is untrue, deceptive, or misleading. Do you think that's plain on its face, or do you think that's ambiguous?
Well, I think there's some ambiguity there, too.
And how would you describe the ambiguity?
Well, one of the ambiguities is what kind of advertising do we have to have before we think about whether these things have happened? And it's the puffery argument I made a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I think there's ambiguity in that regard. Let me just touch, I see that my yellow light's on.
Chief Justice threw out a question to you, Mr. Parsons, about why didn't you just settle this for $10 per cycle. I drew the inference that there was a lot more money potentially at stake here, as much as $500 or $600 for every motorcycle that these folks allege is defective. And if you said $140,000, I calculated $100,000, $500, that's $50 million. But now I didn't get the additional $40,000 that you're talking about. I mean, what is
I lived with the $10 suggestion. No, Your Honor is absolutely correct. The cost of the kit to replace this rear cam bearing, and sometimes it's just this little part, and sometimes given the nature of the noise, they'll use a larger assembly which includes this part and replace that as a kit. That cost is around $500. So that, you know, that's the number you need to think about. And the, you know, our position is, why should we do this if the bike's never going to fail?
And why did you advise them if it's never going to fail? Why did Harley Davidson send any information out if it's not going to fail?
Because Harley Davidson had noticed a limited number of failures, and because Harley Davidson takes care of its riders or it wouldn't sell motorcycles, it thought it was the right and prudent thing to do as a matter of business.
And your cost-benefit analysis was what? That if you had to put in the amount of money of 500 times 100,000, that's the cost. Now, what was the other part of it? How many people might get injured and how much you might have to pay off, which would be less than 500 bucks now? I mean, I want to know what your cost-benefit analysis is.
As I mentioned when I responded to that question, none of this is a record yet, and we're beginning to get beyond the point at which I have knowledge of this.
I understand that, but usually in a cost-benefit analysis, it's how much is it going to cost you? How much will it cost you to do the replacement versus how much you're going to have to ultimately pay off if 1%, 2%, whatever it is, fails and you get personal injury? And the reason I say that is because I think it was the Pinto case where that was the issue. And some of the sales of guns that would, you know, fire off at the shooter instead of the shootee.
The analysis resulted in an extension of the warranty from 1 to 5 years, 50,000 miles. That's how that resolved itself. I see my red light is on. Maybe I'll have the opportunity to hit one final point in rebuttal.
You will. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Selvin, you will be introduced by a Wisconsin attorney, Ted Wachowski.
Chief Justice, members of the court, it's my pleasure to introduce Jonathan Selvin and sitting to his right, Lisa Laveau, both of whom have been admitted pro hoc vice below, both of whom I've worked with on this case and whose offices I've worked with on other matters, and I can represent to the court that they are honorable and competent lawyers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wachowski. Mr. Selvin, you will be admitted pro hoc vici for purposes of arguing before this court today. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court, may it please the court, Jonathan Selvin, on behalf of plaintiff Steve Teatsworth, Dave Bratz, who's here with us today, and others. Your Honors, this is a case about a manufacturer, Harley-Davidson, that lied to Dave Bratz when they sold him his motorcycle. They lied to Dave Bratz and Steve Teatsworth and thousands of other consumers around the country in order to induce them to buy the motorcycles. Dave Bratz bought the motorcycle. Steve Teatsworth bought the motorcycle. They didn't get what they paid for. This is a classic garden variety consumer fraud case where we've asserted, as has been discussed, two causes of actions, common law fraud and a claim under Section 100.18. Harley-Davidson would have this court.
So which paragraphs of the amended complaint contain the alleged lie?
Your Honor, it's a concealment, and let me pull up the complaint. The focus of our claim is a concealment. It's not something they said affirmatively. It's something they didn't say when they did speak. And so I apologize. I need to find a copy of the complaint.
A red brief.
We have alleged that Harley-Davidson knew that the motorcycle was defective. Let me find the allegations. I believe it is in paragraph. The specific allegations regarding the advertising literature are contained in paragraph 21. I'm sorry, in paragraph 22, which references the specific affirmative representations that were made. Paragraph 23 references the specific affirmative representations, but the key here is what's not said. It's the concealment. It's the information they knew, we allege that they knew, and on this motion to dismiss, our allegations must be taken as true, that they knew that, in fact, it would fail. And so those allegations are contained throughout paragraphs 24, 25, 26, throughout the background information there. And then if you flip over, I believe they're repeated.
Counsel, is it 36 yes. You're looking for?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. That's the paragraph. Defendants have knowingly and intentionally concealed or have failed to disclose the true nature and severity of the inherent defect in the motorcycles equipped with the TC-88 engines and the true frequency at which cam bearing engine failures occur. Now, it's interesting. They talk about the fact that they did send out this letter. Our complaint talks about the time when our clients bought these motorcycles. Our allegation is that they knew when they sold our clients these motorcycles that they were defective, and they didn't tell them that. They perpetuated that fraud. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was there a duty to speak at
yes.
that moment?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a duty when you sell somebody a product, particularly a vehicle. Certainly there is a duty if you know that that product is defective and prone to failure. And we should talk about this prone-to-failure issue, because there's two problems with what Mr. Parsons said. The first is we're talking about fraud claims, and the injury in fraud claims is a financial injury that occurs at the moment of the sale. But I also want to talk about, and again, this isn't in the record, it's in our allegations, because there is no record at this point, but we've also talked to innumerable people who own these motorcycles. When this part fails, it fails on the highway. It fails while you're doing 60 miles an hour out on the freeway in the middle of nowhere. This is not a case. It may be that there's not a single instance yet of somebody dying from one of these products failing, but there is a real safety risk here, and I hazard to say that if a company knows that there's a product that is a vehicle that it's selling to people to go out and ride on the highway, that if they know that that vehicle is not safe, they have a duty to speak.
I thought what authority, if I could just follow up on that, because we're dealing with this, whether the complaint is sufficient as a matter of law.
Correct.
So pursuant to what Wisconsin case is this claim being made?
This case is being made pursuant to the DTPA, which is very clear in holding.
You have no common law claim?
No, we do have a common law claim, and I believe there's a common law duty when one is in a superior position and has superior knowledge, and we've cited cases, I believe, in our brief to the effect that when one has superior knowledge with regard to an issue, a material issue, that there is a duty to speak if you choose to speak. In other words, if you choose not to speak at all, there's not a duty. But it's well settled under Wisconsin law, and the name of the case escapes me at the moment, and I apologize. But I know that it's well settled under Wisconsin law that once you begin to speak about a matter, there's a duty of honesty, and there's a duty to disclose material facts.
I think you're probably referring to the Allerman case.
I believe it is the Allerman case. Thank you.
And that was a real estate transaction?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the court declared the duty to speak in that situation because of the non-commercial nature of that real estate transaction?
Right.
And this is clearly a commercial transaction.
This is a commercial transaction, but, Your Honor, this is a transaction between a sophisticated commercial entity and a consumer, where the consumer has no access to the information. This is not a situation where the consumer could go out and find this information on their own somehow. The consumer isn't privy to the research that's been going on at Harley-Davidson. They're not privy to a motorcycle expert. They're in a position where they must rely upon the truthfulness of the manufacturer. And I would be surprised if the law in Wisconsin were different than anywhere else, where once you assume to begin speaking about a product, you have a duty to be truthful. There's a duty of honesty, a common law duty of honesty that exists.
There's a contractual duty of good faith and fair dealing, but
right.
That's not what we're talking about here because this is not a contract claim.
That's right. This is not a contract claim.
Is there a case in Wisconsin that extends the Allerman cause of action to a commercial transaction?
I'm not familiar with one, Your Honor.
And so you're asking us to do so in this case?
Well, yes, I guess in that sense I am, Your Honor. I'm asking you to recognize that the same policy arguments that apply in the Allerman case and that say that there ought to be a duty to be honest and to deal fairly when you're dealing particularly with unsophisticated consumers, that same duty ought to apply. There ought to be a common law duty. There is a common law duty, I would say, to be honest when you're dealing with a consumer in those circumstances. I don't think that's a dramatic extension of the law at all, if it's an extension at all.
No, well, why shouldn't they then abide by their contract causes of action and not a tort of action?
That's a very good question, and part of the answer here is, first, that you're not obligated to only have one cause of action. As this Court has recognized, it's often the case that the same set of facts will give rise to multiple causes of action. I think Your Honor's opinion just this year recognized that it's often the case that you can have a contract claim as well as a tort claim arising from the same set of facts. There's nothing novel about that. Part of the problem with the notion of a contract claim here is, what is this contract that we're talking about? It's a warranty that Harley-Davidson unilaterally issued to these consumers. There was no negotiation at all here. This gets, in fact, to some of the arguments on the economic loss rule. This wasn't a negotiated contract. This wasn't sophisticated parties bargaining back and forth about the nature of the contract, allocating risks. This isn't the situation, I would say, like in DigiCorp, where the Court went out of its way to say that the record was replete with evidence that there had been back-and-forth negotiations.
Well, or even if there wasn't back-and-forth negotiation, can't your client still sue for breach of warranty? I mean,
well,
you have to negotiate for it to be able to use it, do you?
You would think we should be able to sue for breach of warranty. And after this case was dismissed at the trial court level, we brought a lawsuit for breach of warranty. And Harley-Davidson stood up and made precisely the same arguments with regard to our warranty claims that they made with regard to these claims. They said, ah, until your motorcycle fails, until you're stranded in the middle of nowhere, you don't have a cause of action, you know, under warranty, and they prevailed upon that.
That brings me back to a question I was going to ask you earlier. You just represented to us that these motorcycles, or at least some of them, have failed on the highway. Which of the plaintiffs have had their cycle fail anywhere? There were no facts showing that.
Your Honor, and I appreciate the question. As I indicated, the evidence I was talking about is not in the record, and it does not apply to these specific plaintiffs. As I indicated, we've talked to
none of these current plaintiffs.
But I was addressing Mr. Parsons' argument where he was saying off the record that, in fact, this isn't a safety issue, and even though the record doesn't show that, you shouldn't worry about it because it's not a safety issue. What I was indicating is also not in the record, and not with respect to these particular plaintiffs, we've talked to dozens of people who've had these failures on the highway. So I wasn't
But they're not parties to this lawsuit, so they haven't chosen to bring a claim.
We've come across them since this lawsuit was filed. They would be members of the class that we're talking about, but they are not currently any of the named plaintiffs
in this case.
But those
people whose cycles failed could sue for a breach of warranty, right?
They should have a breach of warranty cause of action. Now, Harley-Davidson will tell you probably that they would take care of those people under their extended warranty.
That's a separate question about what they would do.
Right.
I'm really just looking at the pleadings. And as I look at your pleadings and try to line it up with 100.18, which is the claim that actually interests me the most, what you say in paragraphs 22 and 23, those are the representations that you're relying on to satisfy sub 1 of 100.18?
No. It's not our belief that there's anything in 100.18 that requires that you establish that the representations themselves are false, because 100.18 talks about in any way misleading or deceptive.
I understand
and our claim is what they didn't say. It's not what they did say. But, yes, those are the affirmative. That's the advertising we're relying on.
Okay. So if I'm going to look at your complaint and decide whether I think it's sufficient, as I compare it with what's required in 100.18 sub 1, I should look to 22 and 23.
Your Honor, I believe those are the paragraphs where we lay out the affirmative representations were made in the context of which what they didn't say is misleading or deceptive.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
What is it you think that they should have said when they were selling the 1999 and 2000 vehicles?
Well, Your Honor, if, as we allege, they knew at that time that this cam bearing was defective and that it meant that this was not a reliable motorcycle, and you have to sort of understand why it is people buy these motorcycles. These are motorcycles people buy for long trips. They don't ride them necessarily every day back and forth to work. Obviously, some people do. But these are touring bikes. These are bikes people take on long trips, often with their spouse with them on the back of the bike, and they sold these bikes to those people for that purpose. And if they knew that these were not reliable bikes, as we allege they knew, then they should have revealed that. They should have said, hey, look, you may think you're buying a Mercedes, but you're buying a Yugo. And if a Yugo is good enough for you, that's what we're charging you for. But they charged the Mercedes-Benz price, and they sold them a Yugo. They sold them the unreliable vehicle that may or may not get you there. And that's the problem. That's the difference in value. And when you talk about injury, there's been a lot of talk about what the actual injury is here. But the actual injury in a fraud claim, the actual injury in a DTPA claim, it's been settled law in Wisconsin for over 100 years. You look at a snapshot at the time that the product is sold, and you say, at the time that the product was sold, was it worth what they were promised? Did they get what they paid for? And you measure that as the difference in value. And the case law in both the common law, the Gollum versus Jackson case, and the case law under the DTPA, the Kane case, both tell you take a snapshot at that moment, and you don't look to see if there's something else that happens later on.
I think you pled that this machine had a propensity to fail.
Correct.
Is that the same as a reasonable certainty of failing?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know yet because we haven't gotten discovery on what the actual failure rate is of these motorcycles. So what we know is
don't you have to plead a reasonable certainty of failure?
I assume Your Honor is talking about the Hennekins versus Horrell case and the actual damage or reasonably certain future damage. And I think the question, with all due respect, misses the analysis in the fraud and DTPA context, because the question isn't, does it fail? The motorcycle doesn't have to fail for us to have a cause of action. We're not injured. Dave Bratz isn't injured when his cam bearing fails. That would be additional damages. He's injured because he paid for a premium motorcycle, and he paid a premium price for it, and he didn't get what he paid for. And the analysis stops there for whether you have all of your elements for your cause of action.
Why didn't he get what he paid for?
Because what he paid for was not just a motorcycle, as Mr. Parsons said. He paid a premium price for a premium motorcycle. He doesn't have a reliable motorcycle. He doesn't have a motorcycle that he knows he can safely take out on the highway for a long trip out to South Dakota for the big annual event out there. He doesn't have a motorcycle that he knows he can ride safely on the highway. And more importantly, he's got a motorcycle that if he tried to resell it, not only, and I think you're right, he would have to disclose the defect, he's going to get less money for it. He doesn't have to sell it under settled Wisconsin law in order to have a claim, but that motorcycle is worth less. This is not a no-injury case. This is not a case where he hasn't been harmed. Under both Wisconsin fraud law and under the DTPA, you measure the harm at the time of the sale. And the case law just couldn't be more clear on that. You don't have to sell the land. You don't have to wait until the flood occurs to have a cause of action. That's the Gollin versus Jackson case. If you're sold land and you're told that it's not on a floodplain and it won't flood, you can't wait until it floods to bring your cause of action. Your harm has accrued, and the statute of limitations has begun running on that claim, which, of course, work together. The harm has occurred at the moment you're fraudulently sold that land. You don't have to wait and sell the land, and you don't have to wait until it floods. Your harm has occurred. So this whole notion of what is an injury and the injury only occurs when the motorcycle fails is really a red herring in the context of fraud. And I would submit that courts around the country have recognized this. We've heard about this quote-unquote wave of class actions. And I would hazard to say that Dave Bratz is not a wave of class actions. He's a guy who bought a motorcycle and didn't get what he paid for. And that's what this case is about. But this is not a no-injury case. There is real financial harm here. We've talked, again, this is not on the record, and I should be clear, but we intend to bring before the court on trial, at trial, dozens and dozens and dozens of people who have either had these failures or have tried to sell their motorcycle and haven't been able to get a decent price for it, or often have paid out of pocket to fix this. I mean, the irony here is they say there's no injury, but they'll sell you a repair kit for $500 if you want to buy one. That's another way of measuring the damage, and, of course, under Wisconsin law, both of those are allowed. So I think it's
all of that is a tort damage, in your opinion?
It's a fraud damage. The measure of damages under fraud are clear under Wisconsin law.
Why isn't it a breach of warranty of performance for the purposes sold?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, sort of in the nature
Isn't
of an implied
a breach
warranty?
Of your warranty? Yeah, there's an implied warranty of merchantability. I mean, I'm
right. They're privity
lots
issues.
Of years, yeah.
Right. They're privity issues, Your Honor, with respect to implied warranty claims.
Why?
Because not these people didn't all necessarily buy directly from Harley-Davidson. But the point is that there's clearly a
Those
fraud
that
claim.
Did might.
Those that did might have such a claim, Your Honor.
And what would the damage standard be?
Well, Your Honor, the damage measure under Wisconsin law, under all these things, under both the warranty law and under fraud, are benefit of the bargain damages. And I want to say something about that, because I think Harley-Davidson has just gotten the law of damages here flat backwards. Wisconsin does not require you to seek rescission and then sue for damages. It's exactly the opposite. Under settled Wisconsin law, and this has been the law for forever here, is that you can either seek rescission and get your money back. You give the product back, you get your money back. Or you can affirm the contract and sue for damages. And those damages are benefit of the bargain damages. And that's been settled law in this state for well over 100 years, and we've cited the cases in our papers on that point. And I think Harley-Davidson gets it wrong. The case I'm thinking of is the Beers versus Atlas Assurance case, but it's the same in Nate, it's the same in the Schlotthauer case, and it's even the same in DigiCorp. And what the Beers case says is under well-established law, action for damages for fraud and deceit is universally held to involve an affirmance of the contract. In such an action, the plaintiff affirms the contract and sues to recover the amount of damages he has sustained as a result of the fraud practiced upon him. And so I would say that they've gotten that backwards. We've done exactly what the case law in Wisconsin says you're supposed to do. We've affirmed our contracts. We've kept the motorcycles. And we are suing for the benefit of our bargain. And that measure of damages is the same measure of damages under either fraud or contract.
Counselor, a remark you just made interested me very much. When the Chief Justice asked you, why don't they sue for breach of warranty, you said a number of these plaintiffs have no privity. Well, they bought their bike then not from Harley-Davidson, but they bought their bike from some third party. And if they bought their bike from some third party, how did Harley-Davidson right. make a misrepresentation to them under Section 100.18?
They bought the bikes from a Harley-Davidson dealership. So there would be agency issues with respect to the privity. You'd have to establish that they can get from buying from the Harley-Davidson dealer to Harley-Davidson. But all of the information they got came from Harley-Davidson.
Okay,
we're not basing it on oral misrepresentations from the dealer.
Okay, so all of them bought it from a Harley dealer.
That's correct.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
They all bought it from a Harley-Davidson dealer.
Are you seeking punitive damages in this case?
We are not seeking punitive damages in this case.
You were seeking punitive damages?
I'm sorry. I misspoke, Your Honor. We are under the fraud, the common law claim. We are seeking punitive damages, Your Honor. I apologize. I misspoke.
What would you estimate the ballpark figure this case is worth?
Oh, Your Honor, that's a very difficult question. I think your analysis is probably right on with respect to the sort of initial analysis one would do, which is you would take approximately $500, which is how we've valued either the cost of repair or a diminution in value. And I should say, again, we haven't had an opportunity to do any discovery with respect to what the actual diminution in value is. We believe it exists, and we intend to prove it, but we haven't been able to do any discovery. But if you take the $500 per bike as a pretty good proxy, I think Your Honor's analysis is right, and then you get to the issue of punitive damages, and what's available to us in the way of punitive damages I think is too speculative. I as a lawyer, rarely look at a case from what the punitive damage possibilities are. I think the value of the case is in the neighborhood of what Your Honor has said. And in your analysis. I want to speak.
Selden,
yes.
Earlier you had referred to paragraphs 22 and 23 of the complaint and indicated that those were the key paragraphs in regard to the fraud claims here. My response in looking at that is, why wouldn't most people consider this puffery, the kinds of things that are normally said about a transaction of this nature? You're getting a wonderful bike. You're getting a great bike. Isn't that basically what's going on in paragraphs 22 and 23?
It is, Your Honor. And again, I would come back to these are, I think the question was, what are the affirmative representations that bring you within 100.18? These are the affirmative representations. But again, the key to our claim is not those paragraphs. The key to our claim is paragraph 36. It's what they didn't say when it came time to tell the truth. They said those things, and those may or may not be puffery. I would suggest that the case law is fairly clear that that's not proper for determination on a motion to dismiss. At a minimum, that's something for summary judgment, if not for the ultimate trier of fact. But it's again, sort of a red herring. It's what they didn't say. It's what they knew and what they didn't say when they were busy saying that. And again, we intend to prove, because it's true, that what these plaintiffs do when they bought these bikes is they were buying a premium bike. They weren't buying your average, everyday, run-of-the-mill bike. They were buying a premium bike that they could count on and rely upon, and that's not what they got. And they didn't get it because there was this defect that existed in the product at all times. I want to spend just a minute, if I could, on the issue of the economic loss rule. I think the Court has already tuned into the distinction between the common law claim and the DTPA claim. So I won't spend a lot of time on the DTPA claim other than to say that if the economic loss rule applies to the DTPA claim, it wipes it off the books. It won't exist anymore. And there's three reasons why that is the case.
What won't exist anymore?
The DTPA claim for a product, what the DTPA claim is intended to do is to deter fraud in the sale of products and to compensate consumers who bought that product if they've been defrauded.
Do you mean that the DPTA, 100.18 with 100.20, would be wiped off the books? Is that what you said?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what I said, and there's a few reasons why that's the case. The only measure of damages under 100.18 is pecuniary loss. If the economic loss rule bars the 100.18 claim, there's no remedy left under 100.18. If pecuniary loss is an economic loss, what is it? It's the same thing. And so you wouldn't have a remedy left. And the legislature clearly intended to provide a remedy when it enacted 100.18. And with all due respect, obviously, it's not this Court's province to read that statute off the books to wipe that remedy out. There's other reasons why it would wipe the statute off the books. The first is that this Court has an obligation to read the statute to affect the statute's purpose and the legislature's intent in enacting that statute. The legislature clearly intended to provide a remedy that is different than the remedies that exist at common law. Justice Rogenstein, the opinion you are on in the Kalin case makes this point very well. The legislature must have been adding a cause of action here. It wasn't simply parroting the causes of action that already exist at common law. And so if there's a requirement under the DTPA that there be a failure of the product, then essentially all you have is a strict liability or a negligence cause of action. You already have causes of action in the common law that require product failure. So if this Court were to read into the statute something that's not there, a requirement that the product fail, you'd simply have a statute that duplicates the existing common law causes of action. The second reason, or another reason why it would read it off the books or is inconsistent with it, is that, I've already addressed it, is the pecuniary loss issue. So I think it's very clear that the economic loss rule, which is a judicially created common law doctrine, regardless of whether it applies to our common law claim, and I'm going to come to that in a second, it clearly can't apply to a statutory claim. It's inconsistent with it, and it cannot wipe it off the books. With respect to the common law claim, obviously we're aware of the State Farm opinion that this Court issued, and we weren't intending to ignore that opinion. That opinion extended the economic loss rule to consumers in the context of tort claims, strict liability, negligence. All of the policy reasons that apply, that militate in favor of applying the economic loss rule to tort claims, traditional tort claims, strict liability and negligence, all of those disappear in the context of fraud with a consumer. Again, this is the interplay between DigiCorp and State Farm. In DigiCorp, this Court held that the economic loss rule applies to fraud when you're talking about sophisticated commercial entities who can negotiate and allocate risk. In State Farm, you held that the economic loss rule applies to consumers in the tort and negligence area. If you merge the two, if you apply the economic loss rule to unsophisticated consumers in the fraud context, none of the policy rationales make sense. There's no societal interest in protecting a manufacturer that commits fraud.
Counsel, there are lots of cases cited here, and I haven't read all of them, but almost all of them. Has the economic loss doctrine ever been applied to a lemon law case? You know, we have lemon law here in Wisconsin.
You know, Your Honor, the only lemon law case that I'm very familiar with is the Hughes case, in which this Court upheld the lemon law claim as a separate and distinct cause of action. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any case applying it to a lemon law type claim, but I don't want to represent to the Court that there are none because I don't know the answer to that for sure. With respect to the policy reasons that this Court enunciated in the State Farm case, none of those apply when you're talking about fraud. There's no societal interest in protecting fraud. In fact, just the opposite. There's a societal interest in deterring fraud. There's case law that we've cited on this point. You shouldn't be allowed to use contracts to cover up your fraud. And that's really what would happen here. Let's be clear. If the rule Harley-Davidson is proposing is right, then a manufacturer can lie and lie and lie about its product in order to induce you to buy it. And once you buy it, if they unilaterally issue a warranty that you had no ability to negotiate, it's a take-it-or-leave-it warranty, they will have effectively immunized themselves for all of that fraud they committed to get you in the door. Now, it may be the case that in a sophisticated commercial party situation, those parties have a duty and the obligation to negotiate and to learn about this information, and if they want to accept that, that's fine.
Why aren't you lost me there? Why would the manufacturer immunize itself by giving a warranty claim? Don't they just provide an overt cause of action that otherwise you'd have to argue is implied?
They would provide an overt cause of action under a warranty that they have unilaterally issued and whose terms they've decided with limitations on what you can recover and how you can recover. They can wipe out your common law claims. They can wipe out your right to pursue claims based on all of their fraud that preceded the sale simply by giving you a contract claim. And, for example, it would wipe out the ability to seek punitive damages.
Well, that's because contracts don't have punitive damages in Wisconsin. But,
right.
You know, if two parties are together and one wants to buy and the other one wants to sell, and the seller complains he didn't get all that he bought for, and he sues the buyer, and the buyer has to pay him his loss, I guess I don't see why that's immunization. I mean, you don't get punitive damages, but that's what contracts are all about.
But because of the nature of issuing a unilateral warranty that's never been negotiated, it's take it or leave it, here are the terms, you can limit. I mean, Harley-Davidson has told you
that. But we also have implied warranties. And I understand that you can limit it and you can agree in the contract that this is the extent of your warranty actions and so forth. But that's another case. That's not what we're here on.
Right. But my point, I think, is a very important one, and I want to make sure that I'm articulating it clearly. Because I think the problem here is that what it allows a company to do is to immunize itself from its intentional knowing misbehavior. And there can't be a societal interest in that. You can't use a contract to cover up your fraud. And we cited the siding case, and I think it's Anderson versus Tri-State, I may be getting the name wrong, where the court said that contracts, you're not permitted to use contracts to cover up your fraud that you've committed prior to the contract. And I can't imagine there's any societal interest in allowing a company to do that. And so I think it's very important to recognize that a company can do exactly what I said. They can do anything and say anything to get you in. And this is exactly what the DTPA is designed to prevent and what common law fraud is designed to prevent. They can do or say anything to reel you in and then issue a warranty that limits you to whatever they've deigned to give you by way of rights under that contract. And I don't think that can possibly be an appropriate policy rationale to warrant applying the economic loss rule to the common law fraud claim.
You have a very heavy burden here to prove. You've got to prove all the elements of an intentional tort. That at the time of the sale, there was a knowledge that this part was going to fail, that this part's an essential part of the cycle and will cause a lot of trouble. In knowing all that, they sell it anyway. And that later, they make revelation. Well, that's tough proof.
It is, Your Honor, and I see my time's up, but if I may just answer that one question. That's exactly why this isn't going to open the floodgates to litigation that they're trying to warn you about and that some of the amicus talk about. We've got a tough case to prove. We think we can prove it. We think we're entitled to try to prove it. We think we're entitled to get the discovery to try to prove it. But this isn't an easy case, and it's not going to open the floodgates to additional litigation. All of those requirements are still in place. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you all.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Parsons? You wanted to make a point.
I have four, I think, fairly discreet points, which will not take me 5 minutes to cover.
You hope.
First of all, Mr. Selvin talked about covering up the fraud with a warranty, and I think that is simply an erroneous argument. When Harley-Davidson wrote its letter on January 22nd, to all the owners saying there might be a problem with a rear cam bearing and extending the warranty from 1 year to 5 years, it wasn't covering up anything. It was saying, we want you to know we think we might have a problem. Now, if at that point an owner says, now, wait a minute, I'm getting this letter telling me that I might have a problem with my bike. I'm about to get on my bike and ride to Sturgis, South Dakota with a Harley group. I want another bike. That owner could have gone back to the dealer and said, give me my money back. I'm getting a different model bike. I want rescission. And Harley would have had to respond to that, either as a business matter and if it came to a lawsuit, in a lawsuit. There is a remedy of rescission and restitution damages. There is no cover-up. That's the first point. The next point relates to an incomplete answer I gave to questions about the cost-benefit analysis and why Harley didn't recall and repair all these bicycles. What I didn't mention was that as far as Harley is concerned, there wasn't and there never has been and there is not today any issue safety. So when the Chief Justice cited the Pinto case, we don't believe we have anything like the Pinto case. Counsel refers to conversations that he and members of his firm have apparently had with owners who've had problems. Harley hasn't heard about any such problems.
Counsel, I want to stay with the rescission. I'm at home. I'm in Wausau after a busy day here. My husband and I are in the kitchen. We're opening our mail. I get a letter from you that says we think we might have a problem with his motorcycle.
Oh, I don't know.
My motorcycle. You know what I'm going to say to him? I'm going to say, hon, this is what I'm going to say. I'm going to say, hon, just like Justice Crooks had said, no, usually I thought we got these things on recalls, but you're not going to drive that cycle. I see they extended the warranty for 5 years, but you're not going to drive that until it fails and then get it warranted. You're going to have to repair that. I'm not going to have my husband out there driving around the cycle that we think might have a problem. So he's going to have to spend $500 on whatever the cost of installation is. I think that's a reasonable response. Others may not think that I'm prudent in saying that, but I do. So now we've paid not only the, let's say, $40,000 for this vehicle, but now an extra $1,000 because I don't want the potential of having him injured before we can get any satisfaction.
Right. My wife would say the same thing. Go back to the dealer and say, take this bike back.
And you don't think
I don't want it.
You don't think I can essentially affirm the contract and just sue for damages?
Well, I think you could. No, I think you've got to take the bike back.
The only remedy is rescission. Is that what you're saying?
The only remedy, if your position is that you don't want to ride that bike that might have a problem, is rescission.
Great bike, except for, I mean, I love the bike, but for, I just got a letter that said, hey, it might break down. So I want it fixed. I want the bike. I want it fixed. Can't do that. The only remedy. Well, what about under 100.18? The only remedy provided for 100.18, I don't see rescission. It's the only person suffering pecuniary loss. That's the yeah. Damages for 100.18.
Yeah. I want to say something about 100.18. It's a point that hasn't been made yet that's important. Counsel said the key to our case is not what they said, paragraphs 22 and 23. The key to our case is what they didn't say. Well, 100.18 is not a nondisclosure statute. 100.18 does not require affirmative disclosure.
No,
it's a strict liability statute.
It's false, deceptive, or misleading advertising. And in paragraph 28, they assert that they knew, and yet they still allowed these without saying anything to be in the course of commerce. So 100.18 has never required that it has to be only an affirmative statement, because you can have deceptive advertising without disclosure. You can have misleading advertising without disclosure.
I think the court should consider that. In their cause of action, paragraphs 51 and following, the plaintiffs do not allege nondisclosure at all. They allege the affirmative advertising. I just want to make this point because I hope the court will consider it. 100.18 imposes liability on a seller even if the seller had no knowledge nor reason to know, nor in the exercise of reasonable diligence could have known about the problem with the product. You know, we knew nothing about this. You're still liable under 100.18 because it's strict liability. In those circumstances, it should not be interpreted as a statute requiring affirmative disclosure. And as far as we know, it has not been so interpreted. But that's the point, and I leave it there. The last point I wanted to make is this question of, well, apply the economic loss doctrine where we have two sophisticated commercial entities who are bargaining with each other. Don't apply it in a situation where we have consumer fraud and the purchaser doesn't negotiate the terms of the warranty. And, of course, the Harley owner does not negotiate the terms of the warranty with the dealer. The dealer has no authority to negotiate a warranty for Harley-Davidson. But here's the point. Harley-Davidson's warranty is negotiated by tens of thousands of motorcycle buyers who are voting with their pocketbooks when they decide which motorcycle to buy. If they don't think Harley-Davidson's warranty is sufficient, they're going to go buy a Suzuki or a Honda or some other kind of motorcycle. The market performs that function of negotiation, and we submit that the court should consider that when it looks at this case in light of the economic loss doctrine. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Parsons, and thank you, Mr. Selvin, for your excellent arguments this morning on this very significant case. That concludes our hearing on 02-1034. The court will take a very, very brief recess so that the students who are here may leave, other students may come back, and then we can listen to the alarm. Thank you.